Hi, I'm John Harwood, your host for Bedeviled, a podcast about American democracy from the DeWitt Wallace Center for Media and Democracy at Duke University. We bring you conversations with politicians, journalists, and academics about preserving the delicate balance of our fractious system of self-government. Since the Nobel Peace Prize was created in 1901, 111 people have won it, including Theodore Roosevelt, Martin Luther King Jr., Elie Wiesel, and Nelson Mandela. Among the handful of journalists on that illustrious roster is Maria Ressa. She shared the prize in 2021 for her work safeguarding freedom of expression by holding an authoritarian government of the Philippines accountable for its brutality and attacks on the independent press, including multiple criminal charges lodged against her. Born in Manila and educated at Princeton, Ressa holds dual U.S. and Filipino citizenship. Her work as CEO of the online Filipino news site Rappler, which she co-founded, and professor at the School of International and Public Affairs at Columbia University, straddles the two countries. Her 2022 memoir, How to Stand Up to a Dictator, has gained wide currency amid threats to democracy that have gathered momentum around the world. As Donald Trump begins his second presidency with plans to consolidate power within the White House, Ressa warns that the U.S. stands just a hop, skip, and a jump from the sort of repression that has beset her native country. I interviewed her recently about prospects for the new U.S. administration, the role of large technology companies in fueling populist anger, and whether journalism remains a viable check on government power. Maria Ressa, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, John.
Let me start by asking a question about you. You won the Nobel Peace Prize, which is about as great an honor as somebody can receive in this world. And the temptation is to think, well, once you've received that award, your problems are no longer present. But as I read from your book, you remain under criminal charges that you don't know if they will ever be mobilized to wreck your life. Tell me about what freedom you have to operate right now.
I mean, in many ways, the Philippines, we've moved from hell, which is when we had like up to 30,000 people killed in about 3 years. This is human rights estimate, the Human Rights Commission's estimate, from hell to purgatory. And the criminal charges against me went hand in hand with that, right? So there was a year, 2019, when I got 10 arrest warrants, and I would come home and I'd be arrested. To today, I'm down to 2 criminal charges.
Does it mean that you needed permission from the government to make the trip that you're now on to New York City?
Always, every month. I file every single travel that I do outside the Philippines, and I must.
So you straddle two worlds, not only two worlds, but the worlds of the United States and the Philippines. There are people in the orbit of the new U.S. administration that's taking power who talk about going after journalists. Do you think that the specter of media persecution in the way that you have suffered it is a real prospect in the United States?
It already is. Our Constitution was literally a copy of the U.S. Constitution. We have 3 branches of government. We have freedom of the press. All of these things have been enshrined. And what happened in the Philippines is that within 6 months of President Duterte taking office in 2016, those institutions crumbled. We saw, as we are seeing in the United States, leaders in business genuflecting in advance, because then you can cut great deals. It's alarming for me to see the same thing happening all over again. And the first things that we saw, of course, are journalists coming under attack. But what that means is that democracy crumbles, checks and balances crumble. I am really worried that America is moving into hell and must come out. The corruption begins in the information ecosystem.
To the extent that you see this happening in multiple places, the Philippines, Europe, Canada, United States, is this a situation where America is not exceptional and this is basically all the same set of processes, the same political and media trends?
absolutely. Big tech took over, I would say, in 2014. What we saw starting in 2014 was the seeding, there are two ways, the seeding of a meta-narrative that is then opportunistically pounded to make it go viral, that then when you say a lie a million times, it becomes a fact, right? You create alternative realities. And what we saw, I pegged at 2014 because that's when we saw the meta-narrative seeded by Russia that allowed it to annex Crimea. And then 8 years later in 2022, that same meta-narrative, now pounded repeatedly, opportunistically in that time period, in those 8 years, that was the same meta-narrative used by Putin to invade Ukraine itself. Videm in Sweden said that 71% of the world is now under authoritarian rule. We are literally electing illiberal leaders democratically. So again, that is the net effect of going to the cellular level of democracy to insidiously manipulating the people who will vote. They change, they hack our biology, fear, anger, and hate, to change the way we feel, to change the way we see the world, to change the way we act.
Is there anything that you see that is positive about this populism?
You know, I would say over time, that the positive parts of it have really diminished. The struggle of the world today is to define for each of us whether rule of law still exists. What we increasingly see are men who behave with impunity, Putin invading Ukraine, Netanyahu on Gaza, right? These are incredible. The world is watching while this is happening, while innocent people are just trying to live their lives and are getting killed. This is what happens when people have no facts. And I became a journalist because information is power. But broadcast journalists, we used to have news organizations had a set of standards and ethics. And all of that has been eroded by the distribution system that has been created by big tech, which rewards the bad, rewards the worst of humanity.
Well, this is what's fascinating about your book, How to Stand Up to a Dictator, because initially, as you just indicated, you saw social media as part of the answer.
Yeah.
And you describe an arc of disillusionment that you're suffering. And I guess my question is, to the extent that social media is problematic, is that inherent in the medium? Is it about the specific people running these companies, or is it about the structure of the industry and the fact that it's a small number of companies that are in charge?
Oh, it's both. You know, so I would say I did drink the Kool-Aid, literally. And Rappler was the equivalent of an alpha partner of Facebook in the Philippines. And for 6 years in a row until 2021, Filipinos spent the most time online and on social media globally. Facebook is our internet. Today, 100% of Filipinos on the internet are on Facebook. Facebook is our internet. When I met Mark Zuckerberg, and I wrote about this in the book. This was 2017, I think. 97% were on Facebook.
And he said, what about the other 3%?
Correct. The design of the platform is maximum profit. Profit at all costs. Mark Zuckerberg has said this, profit over country. Company over country. This turned the world upside down. By design, lies spread 6 times faster as of 2018. And personalization means that by design, the tech company will give you what you want. So there are two of us now talking. What if we have two different realities? Well, the company will give it to us because then we'll keep scrolling. But that means we can't actually work together. We can't have the same shared reality. We can't have the same facts. Facts become things, illusions. I say this all the time. It would be like living in an insane asylum. This is not a world we want to live in, but it is a world where Facebook gets more than $300 billion a year, right, in revenue. So the question there is, why was this industry allowed to be unregulated for so long? And how did the myth continue?
So how did you react when you heard Joe Biden say in his farewell address that Americans needed to be on guard against the tech industrial complex and an oligarchy that was developing in the United States.
I wish he had said it 4 years ago. There's a point I want to make now that is the same all around the world, right? Because the way dictators-to-be information operations or information warfare, the way that happens is by repeatedly pounding, you know, a million times a day if you want, right? I was getting 90 hate messages per hour, but pounding a fracture line of society so that you split society wide open. And the two fracture lines that have been pounded repeatedly all around the world are two things, gender and race, pitting us against each other. If you're a minority in the real world, you become more of a minority in the virtual world. Someone can repeatedly pound a meta-narrative about LGBTQ+, if you're Black, if you're brown, if you're a woman. This is alarming, having lived through this before.
I read an interview this morning with Mark Andreessen, who's somebody you may know. He described his own, the arc that he's traveled, and he said that, you know, beginning in the 1990s and the 2000s, he was a Democrat. He saw Democrats as a voice of progress and humane cultural values and all that. But he's now turned it around and said that the people like him who run companies have been victimized by the radicalization of the left, who are essentially anti-capitalist and sending mobs against them. React to that.
I think that's gaslighting. And the evidence will show that. If you want profit at all costs, money at all costs, that means you want no laws. And that's actually what they've had for a long time. They don't want laws that protect people, that would limit in their minds the wealth they can create, the profits they can make. I mean, how much money is enough money? Where you then stop and you begin thinking about the public good, right? I think that's the part that Mark Andreessen may not understand. The tech industry is the least regulated globally. The harms have been documented. What are the two harms that I think are critically important? The first is election integrity. Romania decided to void an election because of Kremlin manipulation on social media. But imagine if the United States in 2016 did that, or the UK in 2016 and Brexit did that, the world would be significantly different, right? So that's election integrity. Let's talk about real world violence, which is genocide. I'll go as far as that, right? We know that in 2018, in Myanmar, my part of the world, both the United Nations and Meta sent people to look at genocide in Myanmar. And both of them came up with the same conclusion, which is that Facebook enabled that violence, enabled genocide. And yet no one was held accountable, right? No one was held accountable. You know, you need journalism to have democracy survive. We're losing good journalists. And frankly, if you were a young, idealistic graduate, would you choose to go to journalism? Only if you care about democracy, only if you have great role models, right? I think Freedom House and VDEM will show you that it's been almost 20 years of attacks against journalists. And our the incoming president-elect, president-elect Trump, has actually said, you know, he'll keep hitting journalists because then you won't believe them.
You talked in your book about a triad of things that are the answer to the threats to democracy you mentioned: technology, community, journalism. In light of the difficulties or the shattering of the business models of legacy media, is it still a viable contributor to society? Does it still matter?
I think it always will matter if you want democracy to survive.
Can legacy media survive?
Actually, it depends on what you do, what American media does in this time period. Don't allow yourself to get bulldozed back or voluntarily give up your rights, which is, I think, what we're seeing happening. Corporate media will follow the money.
I can imagine that some people listening to this podcast may hear the way you talk about profit and say, she's against profit, she's against capitalism. Is that true?
No, absolutely. Well, let me redefine this, right? The former finance minister of Greece, Yanis Varoufakis, actually wrote a book where he said that tech companies today are now so powerful that there's that capitalism essentially is dead. He claims that capitalism has been replaced by something he calls techno-feudalism, because big tech is a layer that creates no product. It literally is a rent-seeking industry. So what is the product? It is us as people. It takes our energy, our data, and uses that, and then uses it against us.
On that question of democracy, the rule of law, as we see from measures like those done by Freedom House, it's not binary. It's not a light switch that you turn on and off. It's a continuum. Where would you say the United States is right now with respect to democracy and the rule of law?
It's a hop, skip, and a jump to where the Philippines was. Take a look at Project 2025. Right? Is that really President Trump's roadmap? He claims no, and yet a lot of the things are being set in place. And what Americans do today will determine whether democracy survives. And I worry that the United States is following the Philippines. The outgoing Surgeon General Vivek Murthy just came out with what he said. Look, he wrote about the impact of big tech on the youth, higher levels of suicide. He wrote this paper that showed you the epidemic of loneliness. We now live in a world where community is gone.
As the new administration gets underway, what are the most important things, that is the new American administration gets underway, what are the most important things you're watching, say, over the next year?
Checks and balances. Whether or not America continues on a line of impunity, right? Like, I think what we forget is that the laws are in place, but if they're not implemented by government, then it is still lawlessness. Will America's civil society groups reinvent what civic engagement means in an age of exponential lies? Will we stand up to the robber barons, the new robber barons? Hi, Mark Andreessen and Mark Zuckerberg, right? In January 6th happened. I mean, Silicon Valley sins came home to roost on January 6th. And yet, this is now being transformed in front of our eyes. If you do not stick to rule of law, Republican or Democrat, then you will not have a society that will be democratic.
You close your book with a very jarring scene where you gather at a family event with your cousin, who's a police officer, and you run into some of the same attitudes and points of view that you've been seeing as the product of manipulation and tech misbehavior. What does that tell you about in your own family, about the intractability of this problem?
That last scene is not in the Philippines. It's in Toms River, New Jersey, which is where I grew up. They never used to be this polarized. There's a great quote by Yuri Andropov, the former KGB chair, former head of the Soviet Union, secretary general of the Soviet Union, I think. He said that disinformatia is like cocaine. You take it once or twice, you're okay. But if you take it all the time, you become an addict. We've had, let's say, a decade, we're coming up on a decade of this, of disinformation pounded for power and money. That transforms us at the cellular level, each of us as people, right? The inflaming violence and hate. This is the inciting to violence. This is something that, you know, would have been illegal in the real world. Like, you can't scream fire in a theater in the real world, and yet you can online, right? Like, anyway, so this does change people. And then it takes a long time to come back. That's what has transformed our world. That's the termites eating away the wood that we stand on. We move from hell to purgatory. And I have great hope that we will do better. 3 years ago, we began to build an entirely new public tech ecosystem, a Matrix Protocol chat app. It is open source. It's secure. When you join this, you will be in a shared reality, real people talking to real people in a shared reality. If we cannot have accountability of big tech, then why do we need to stay with big tech? Broligarchy, and I'm not the one who coined this term, right, to take the oligarchy that President Biden talked about, and to see the way Elon Musk has behaved globally, you can get a sense of the kind of impunity that they believe they can get away with.
Maria Ressa, thanks so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure. Thanks for listening to Bedeviled. This podcast is possible because of the DeWitt Wallace Center for Media and Democracy at Duke University. It's produced by Maria Luisa Frasson-Nori. Music from Blue Dot Sessions. You can listen to Bedeviled on all podcast platforms.